I have to go finish my PLA presentation I'm doing anyway, so I won't keep you too long for.
Oh, are you going to PLA?
Dinner. Yeah, that's next
Everybody's
week.
Everybody's going to PLA, man. Jealous. And then I realized, like, it doesn't really matter because I'm not a public. I mean, I am because I've applied for enough librarian jobs that I've been like slowly edumacating. Like, yes, I am a real librarian.
Well, and you used to work at a public library, didn't you?
Yeah, I've worked, and all my career's been in public library. Yeah. And I honestly consider this a public library. It just has a special focus.
Right,
because
right.
I have so many. I am familiar with the public.
This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. This episode comes from the Public Library Association Conference in Denver, Colorado in 2016. My guests from the conference are Brett Bonfield, Samantha Chatta, Megan Emery, Becky Yost, and Ryan Claringball, with a special guest appearance by Dolly Murley there at the beginning. At the end of the interviews, you'll hear my how-to podcast presentation that I gave at the conference. Hope you enjoy as much as I enjoyed the conference.
I am here at Duck Soup with Brett Bonfield. We're having lunch, and it was very delicious. I'll leave Brett to decide if his is delicious or not. And we're going to talk a little bit about, Brett, you have a new job at the Princeton Public Library. Can you talk about why you decided to make a move and what you're excited about at Princeton?
I'm excited about everything at Princeton. I think that kind of answers the question about why I decided to make the move. It's an incredible community, a much more diverse community than I think people realize, and a really progressive community, and a community that has the same values I have. And so it's really nice to be part of that. I've been welcomed, and it is a community that, because of the universities there, it changes a lot, and I think people are accustomed to people moving in and again, kind of opening up their arms and their homes and being really friendly. And so it's nice to be part of this small town of about 30,000 people or so. That's also cosmopolitan and diverse and progressive and loves its library. They put me on the cover of Princeton Magazine, which is just really weird. I never expected to be quite so conspicuous. I mean, I went to library school. The plan was to be a librarian. It wasn't to end up on magazine covers ever, and it's kind of uncomfortable. But it's a statement about the library. It has nothing to do with me, and I'm very aware that it has nothing to do with me. Whoever they hired would have been put on the magazine cover because that's how they feel about their library. And so that means that there's so much energy around the library and so much possibility. And I have amazing, amazing colleagues who are so focused on the community and customer service and really doing their best to make it the best library in the world. And that's a really wonderful thing.
And does that present any kind of like unique challenges that you're in a community that has the college nearby? I mean, I know that when you have, does that population come to the library too, the college ones, or they kind of stick on campus, or are you mostly kind of just serving the people who are there as their home?
Well, I think it's both. A lot of the graduate students will live off campus. A lot of the faculty will live in the community. We give library cards to everybody who's affiliated with the university. And it's a wonderful place to study. I mean, the university has multiple libraries. Firestone Library is undergoing this enormous, wonderful renovation. That's their main library. They have a Geary-designed library. So there's some beautiful libraries on campus, but the Princeton Public Library is also really great. And we have speakers and programs that attract the students and faculty. And we just have this really wonderful study space that, you know, if you don't want to worry about running into your classmates or other faculty members, you just want to sit and read quietly or do research, you know, we're just a couple of blocks from campus and they come over and make use of it. And we feel good about that.
What do you like about attending PLA specifically? I mean, what kind of energy do you get from PLA that you don't get at another conference, like at an ALA? I know for me personally, ALA is a little overwhelming because it's 20,000 people as opposed to maybe, 5, 6 at PLA. But What do you get out of PLA specifically?
I'm actually still figuring that out. I think this is only my third PLA. It's only every other year, and I think I've only gone to every other PLA since I went into librarianship. I know I went to Portland, and I know I went to the one in Philadelphia because I was 7 miles from the one in Philadelphia. But I'm still kind of finding my place in PLA. I actually prefer ALAs. I actually enjoy getting together with people who work in very, very different libraries, especially academic libraries. I feel like I have so much to learn from people in academic libraries, in part because they're great and in part because I don't work in an academic library, so I have almost everything to learn. But they're ahead of us on things like assessment and plenty of other activities that I really care about. And so it's nice for me to be able to sit down with them and sit in on committee meetings and things like that at ALAs. So PLAs tend to be much more practical. The programs tend to be very practical. The conversation tends to be very practical. But I'm practical all the time. So it's still something I'm learning to really understand well. I mean, I enjoy them. It's not a question of not loving it when I do go. But a lot of times I will prioritize other conferences over PLA if I have to make a choice.
I think the difference for me is that I have this, the podcast, where I get to talk to other people all the time about, I can talk to academic librarians, special librarians, school librarians, and I get that interaction all the time. So I guess I like the practical aspect of PLA because it's something different for me. So we were talking earlier at lunch and you asked me a question, so I'm going to ask you it back. What excites you about libraries these days?
I think for me the most exciting thing that's happening in libraries right now is Library Freedom Project and Allison McCrina's work. What I've been trying to figure out with her for the last 6 months or a year is how we can get an Allison McCrina in a lot more libraries. She was at Watertown Public Library right outside Boston, and she was there full-time, and she was making sure that their technology policies and their technology itself and their training program had privacy built into it. And I think that's amazing. And I want to have that at Princeton. And I want to have that at Ann Arbor. And I want to have that in Philadelphia. And I want to have that everywhere. I want privacy to be a huge part of libraries' brand. I know it's part of our core values. And I know that we know it. But when you talk to people who just use public libraries, they have no idea that we get rid of the records of their having borrowed a book once it comes back. And when I explain to them the idea of intellectual freedom, it resonates with them. What I tell them is that universities have the tenure system not for job security for the faculty, but it's so they can research whatever they want. And the idea is that anybody who walks into a public library essentially has that tenure. They're allowed to research whatever they want. And that's one thing that we want to provide to people, but we don't necessarily have the skills yet to do that. And I think we really need to have more people and more libraries with those skills in order for people to understand. So what I've been trying to figure out is a way to kind of create a cohort of Allison McCrina's with her assistance. And so I have no idea if we'll be able to pull it off, but I think it would be pretty amazing, and I would really love for, you know, rather than fines and shushing and buns and all that kind of stuff to be part of the library brand, I really want people to know to come to us if they want to understand how to keep themselves safe and protected and free online.
I think that comes up even more all the time now in just pop culture stuff and just general mainstream culture, because things like the Apple thing with the FBI, people are aware of these issues a lot more now, and the fights over encryption that are coming in Congress, whether they're going to try to outlaw it and all this kind of stuff. It's important for people to understand that and not just believe the sound bites. It was even encouraging to hear a lot of the politicians, like Lindsey Graham. I remember at the beginning of the FBI Apple thing was all totally FBI, and then he said, I met with some people, they talked to me about it, I learned about it. Now I'm on Apple side, so it's education, and that's what we're all about. So since we're at PLA, do you have anything else coming up at the conference that you're looking forward to specifically, or anybody else you're looking forward to finding and talking to?
Yeah, there's a few people that I'm really excited to see that I always try to see whenever I can. And so we'll see how that goes if we're actually able to make those drinks and those meals happen. But I'm definitely looking forward to that. I'm also really looking forward to talking to some of the vendors. I don't usually spend a ton of time on the exhibition floor because I was at a small library. Our budget was, you know, about $500,000 a year, and the vast majority of that went to staff. And so there wasn't a lot I could do with vendors. And now I can do a whole lot more with vendors. And I'm dedicated not just to getting good deals for Princeton and our community. I'm also dedicated to the fact that vendors pay a little bit more attention to what we do and leveraging that. For instance, I'm very interested in signing the Digital Privacy Pledge. And so I'm going to all of our current database vendors and also our potential database vendors that I would like to work with and saying, we need to have HTTPS enabled. We're about to sign this pledge, and we're not going to sign any new contracts or renew any contracts unless HTTPS is enabled. So I'm really looking forward to having these conversations. And for the most part, I'm not the first person they're hearing from. But every now and again, already, I've found that I am. And in some ways, that feels even better. Maybe I'm the one who's going to have them go, it's going to cost us, $100 for a wild card certificate, and it's going to take half a day for one of our techies. Yeah, this is something that's worth doing. We're going to do that. So yeah, I'm looking forward to having those conversations.
Well, thanks a lot, Brett, and I hope you have a good conference.
All right, thank you.
All right, I am here at the Wincoop Brewing Company, as you can tell from the background noise. I am here with Samantha Chata from the Wayne County Public Library. And before we get started, actually, Sam, can you tell the listeners a story about what we did on our way over here in our cab?
We had a very pleasant cab driver, and as we were driving over, we were asking him about the bar that we're at and what we should get, and he just, what was he saying? Just get food?
Get food and get drink.
It's like, yeah, we understand that, but what would you recommend? Food and drink. But to all of our delight, he did have his library card with him.
And he showed it to us, and you can go look at Sam's Twitter account to see the photographic evidence of that. So what is it that's exciting to you about libraries today and going forward into the future? What makes you excited to be a librarian?
I'm really excited about the concept of the lending of unusual items, as we're now kind of calling it. I think it's really cool that libraries can be a community hub where people can come and check out various items like a record player, a Roku device, the internet, a GoPro, or some of the Steam kits that Skokie's working on. It's just evolved so much from when I was a little girl to where it is now, and to see that coupled with technology that's had been advancing, it'll be very interesting to see the role that libraries continue to serve with emerging tech, because it's not slowing down anytime soon.
Well, and it's nice because I don't think you're one of those people that some people get concerned that they're talking about, well, throw all the books away and just go to technology, but it's an additional thing. I mean, we're growing into new things, so.
You can't get rid of the physical book. I'm a technologist, I was a tech librarian, but at the end of the day, I still had a physical book on my nightstand. I like my Kindle, I use it, but there's nothing more comforting than snuggling up with your hardback and, getting lost in the story as you fall asleep.
All right. Thank you very much, Sam, for talking to me.
Thank you, Steve.
All right, here at the 5280 Burger Bar with Megan Emery from Chattanooga. How has your conference been so far, Megan?
I'm having an excellent, excellent conference.
What's the big takeaway that you've gotten so far, or better, best session that you've gotten so far?
So I just attended the Creating Spaces for People and Not Books Necessarily, that one with the Doc One, and it's really exciting to see that the user-based experiences that libraries have been creating for so long have sort of a shape and a name that we can all identify with now. And I love the idea of where that's going to go next.
And we've been talking as we've been having our meal that these in-person interactions are just as good as the sessions themselves. So have you been able to do that? Have you meet a lot of people afterwards, or drinks, parties, meals, things like that too?
Yes, I have I have had the best time catching up with people who I've previously met, especially at PLA, because the caliber of the attendees here is always so fabulous. But in addition, in my 2 years, now 2.5 of Chattanooga, you know, I'm making different friends than I was making when I was in Maine, and a lot more online relationships have been formed. And so I've gotten to meet in person a bunch of like library crushes I've had for a long time. And so that has been like a stellar experience.
Library crushes, you heard it here first. So can you tell the listeners kind of basically what your job is at Chattanooga, what you do?
Great. So I kind of got to invent my own job description, which is super fortunate. If you haven't tried that, try it. It's hard. So I go by experience designer and coordinator, because ultimately I feel that's the bulk of what I do. I create programming, be it walk-up, pop-up, traditional, or whatever the future is. There's no name for it yet.
Right.
For both the second floor of the Chattanooga Public Library's downtown branch, which is our tween and teen department, and now I'm also creating programming for the fourth floor, which is our makerspace. So I love the idea of this seamless transition and never having to lose an age bracket. So I feel like not that we missed the mark, you know, when we started focusing on teens, but unless we have tweens to grow into teens, we're losing that age range. And similarly, if you look at this idea that, oh, now everybody's like hot and bothered about the 20 and 30 somethings and how do we get them back, and it's like, well, don't lose
snake
them
people.
Don't stop programming when you've got an 18-year-old. Ask them what they want next, and if it's college support or job support, work on those things.
So what excites you about being a librarian now? What's exciting in the world of libraries that really gets you jazzed up now?
Okay, so I've had this conversation a couple times with many iterations of people, like those after sessions that we were just talking about. The three of us were just talking about this. I'm so excited about taking the idea of the qualitative experience that librarians are really, really good at presenting and wrapping it up in some numbers, creating data sets that people can point to as examples of successes that have already taken place. Because we're always going to be really good at telling the sweet stories and the lovely stories, but if we can transform that into some data of the qualitative experience and benefits that we're providing our communities, it just provides so much more of an impact to people that don't understand what libraries are doing.
Awesome.
Hey.
Well, thank you for talking to me, Megan.
Thank you, Steve.
Bye. I'm here with Becky Yost at PLA, and Becky, what was your session that you presented on yesterday?
Okay, the session I presented on yesterday was de-identifying patron data for data analysis. And so the problem with all the data that we have in various systems, for example at SPL, is that we have data that of our collection, independent of how users are borrowing it. We have data about patrons, like patron records, but we don't have data about completed transactions. And various third-party vendors have statistics about usage, like Overdrive, Frigo, and whatnot. And we're making decisions on how to spend resources for collections, services, and whatnot through some anecdotal data and some very high-level data analysis. But at the same time, we're not really sure about long-term patron behavior. Now, we could go about it in the way that Amazon or Facebook goes about data collection and the way that they market to various users, what they should read next, what they should like, what they should buy. But that's way too far into data collection, surveillance, SPL and librarianship in general, very dedicated to free inquiry and privacy. So we're not even wanting to get even near that part. At the same time, we end up deleting a lot of data. SPL doesn't keep records on what you visited for websites, what books you've checked out. That gets cleared out from the system. So basically all this data goes away. At the same time, we have to figure out a way where we can use the data that we have in a responsible way to make informed decisions to essentially make decisions about how to spend taxpayer funds responsibly and making sure that we are marketing to the people who need certain resources the most. And so the project that we're working on, SPL, is called the Data Warehouse. And with the Data Warehouse, we're looking at integrating a lot of data sources, some data sets like door counts, patron demographic data, circulation, computer usage sessions. But this data, we have to make sure that we are stripping out any personally identifiable information. So a lot of people think of PII, personally identifiable information, as name, date of birth, social security number, but we approach it with at a two-facet approach, which is information about you and information that you do that could be linked to you. So in the case of libraries, that is your intellectually identifiable information, what books you've checked out, what websites you've visited, what search queries you executed. In this data warehouse, we are taking steps to scrub both PII1, so name, date of birth, whatnot, and PII2, essentially making sure we don't have full call numbers in the data warehouse, for example, because call numbers, if you have the full call number, it's just as bad as having the title. And so we're trying to find the right methodology where we can have enough blurry data. For example, when we talk about blurry, you have the example of, do you record someone's date of birth or you record someone's age? Age is a lot blurrier because if you say someone's 40 years old at a certain date, you have a year time span of where that date of birth might be. And then if you go date of birth, well, you got the date of birth, and if you find their address, you can probably crack into various less secure systems online. And so finding that right balance of having that granularity where we can do long-term analysis on patron behavior to better inform what services we provide, and at the same time upholding our pledge for privacy for our patrons.
Yeah, my wife works in public health, so she deals with a lot of the same issues of stripping out identifiable information when they are reporting all their diseases and all that kind of stuff. So, the other thing I wanted to ask you was, what I'm kind of asking everybody is, other than what you just talked about, what is it that's exciting you about libraries now? What's exciting to you as a librarian?
Well, I can talk personally on my end because I just started at Seattle Public Library 4 months ago. And this is the first public library that I've worked for. I've been at various different sizes of academic libraries. So what's exciting for me right now is that I finally get to put into practice what has been termed big tent librarianship, is making those connections and crossovers between different subsets of librarianship, making those connections and bring in some of the stuff that I've seen and done in academic side, but as well as seeing some stuff that's been done with special libraries and school libraries and learning the public library world and seeing how I can integrate and seeing what I can bring back from the public world to my academic and school and special library contacts. So for me, what's exciting right now is basically I have a new field to play in. And just for me, I'm in the listening mode right now, just seeing what are the main priorities for Seattle Public Library and also for the regional libraries, both academic, special, public, and school. And for me, yeah, it's more personal what you're excited for. But I get to see a whole new subset of my followers on Twitter, for example, and the Troublesome Catalogers, our group on Facebook and Twitter. So it's good to make those new connections and reestablish old connections. And I think it is a good opportunity to get big tent librarianship up to the forefront again, because honestly, I believe we have a lot to learn from each other, and I want to carry forward that idea from Andy and keep chugging along.
All right, well, you're at the right place for that. So, thank you very much, Becky. All right, I'm here with Ryan Claringbull. And Ryan, can you tell me, just to start with, let listeners know what your job is, what you do for a living?
Yes, I'm the Public Library Technology Consultant. I work for the Public Library Development Team with the Division for Libraries and Technology at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, which is essentially our state library.
Okay. And what kind of stuff do you do on an everyday basis with that? Do you work with libraries or do you work directly with patrons, customers like that?
No, I don't work with patrons, though we do occasionally get the call where someone will Google, like, Wisconsin Library and get our telephone number and ask us, you know, my book's overdue, which unfortunately we can't help them out with that. But I work with the 380-plus libraries, public libraries in Wisconsin, as well as the 17 regional library systems on many different things. I'm the technology consultant, so all things technology. Right now we're trying to focus on privacy. I also am the E-rate contact for the Wisconsin Public Libraries, deal with broadband issues and improvements, makerspace programs, 3D printers and whatnot, and also kind of a side subject, I was the co-lead for iLead USA in Wisconsin, and we're looking to do more programs like that going forward.
Okay. And what kind of conference have you had? Are there any specific sessions that have stood out for you that really inspired you?
So many are great. I just recently came back from the one on talking about the Rabble with the Yahara Music Project that was launched at the Madison Public Library, which is collecting all the local music and making it available digitally to the people in the community where they could either stream or download it. That's a great model, and we're looking to see, you know, could that be done on a statewide platform? The Renee Myers big talk in the morning is on diversity inclusiveness. That's something I'm personally very curious about and trying to move forward with, and I'm still thinking about that. There was the de-identification project at the Seattle Public Library, which I'm still thinking about. So, yeah, a lot of great sessions I'm still processing.
Yeah, and listen, I had Becky on from the de-uniquing. So listen to the other parts of this episode to hear a little bit more from her on that one, because that does sound like a really good project and really interesting stuff. So in general, like, what is exciting to you about being a librarian now, or just about libraries in general? What gets you really going besides, you said, like, diversity and things like that? What else is exciting for you in the field?
The most exciting thing for me is the librarians. I'm a very curious individual. I think why I'm in the profession is because I am so curious, and I'm surrounded by other curious people and very knowledgeable people that know so much more than me, that I can always ask questions and learn more, and people that care about helping others and serving their community. And I think some people think that the public library might be considered like the brain of the community, where I think it's actually the heart of the community. It's something that there's so much feeling and wanting to help in libraries, and it's something that I just will never get sick of. It's great to see others serving their communities so selflessly.
Yeah, and that's what I think what's great about this conference is that we can all kind of get together and share those ideas and how we do that together and have our own inspire each other, so it's great. Right, well, thanks a lot, Nick.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Steve Thomas. I am a branch manager at Gwinnett County Public Library, and I do two podcasts. One is called Circulating Ideas, and it is a podcast about interviewing librarians of all types. I talk to public librarians, academic librarians, school librarians, all of them. I want everybody to know what it is that librarians do, and to let other librarians get inspiration from that. I also do a podcast called Withdrawn, and that is with law librarian Dolly Murley. It's a little looser, a little funnier, and we kind of handle one big topic per season and walk through that. Like the first season was walking you through your library career from becoming a librarian through library school all the way to retirement. I also do I do 2.5 podcasts. One of them is a half a podcast at my workplace. We have just started a podcast, and I have done a little bit of work doing interviews for that, but I've also done some production work in the background, so I'm involved in that, but it's not necessarily my baby like the other ones. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Just what the heck is a podcast? Well, the word comes from the mixture of the words iPod and broadcast. So iPod plus broadcast equals podcast. And that's because the iPod itself is what mainstreamed the format. But you don't need a shiny Apple product to play a podcast, of course. They are just MP3 files. My short definition is that they are on-demand talk radio available through the internet. You can stream them or download them. Most people download them as more broadband becomes available, and the easier it is to download big files, the easier it will be to stream and not have to download. You subscribe to them via RSS, so that when a new episode comes out, it automatically comes to your podcast player, and we will move on now to talk about that. Podcast apps. The biggest one is the this is cleverly named Podcasts app by Apple, and that is available on every iOS device, and it's one of those undeletable apps, so it's on every iPhone and every iPad. And Google is starting to also dip their toe into this. So the Google Play Music app will support podcasts soon. It's not everywhere yet, but they are slowly getting into that. And then there are other companies like Stitcher, and then independent developers like Overcast and Pocket Casts. Overcast is iOS exclusively, but Stitcher and Pocket Cast are on iOS and Android. And they're a podcast app for Windows Phone, BlackBerry, kind of everything you can think of. And there are podcasts about everything, basically any subject you can think of. If you think of underwater basket weaving, there is probably a podcast about that. Just like we always said, there's a book about everything and there's a website about everything. It's getting to be the point where there's a podcast about everything. You can do it by yourself. You can do it with other people. You can have just guests on that you talk to. Like on my show, I have guests on that I interview, but that's Circulating Ideas. And then on Withdrawn, the other podcast, it's me and Dolly talking back and forth. The breakout podcast that you've probably heard of is Serial, and it's from the producers of This American Life, which of course airs on NPR, and NPR has been pretty big into the podcast world, usually just pushing their regular shows like Car Talk, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, all those kind of shows, Fresh Air, things like that, and just pushing them out as podcasts. And then there are also independently produced shows like these here. 99% Invisible is about architecture. WTF is interviews with comedians. Welcome to Night Vale is a weird radio drama thing that's you have to kind of listen to understand. It's very popular. And then there are independently produced networks of shows, which are usually on the topic of geek culture or technology, because surprise, surprise, geeks are the ones that think of producing audio and putting it on the internet. And I will take the fifth as to whether I am one of those. But say you want to start your own podcast. So what do you need? Well, you need an idea, obviously. You need to have something that you want to talk about, and you want to talk about something that you are passionate about, because a podcast is something that you want to kind of keep going as an ongoing thing. And if you're not passionate about something, you're not going to want to talk about it over and over and over again. Now, obviously, I am passionate about libraries, which is why I do multiple podcasts about libraries. And since we're at the Public Library Association conference, I am going to focus on that. So as you can see here, there are a lot of library podcasts. There are a lot more than I'm listing on my slides. There's one about training, which T is for training. User experience in libraries, usually on the web, that is LibUX. Secret Stacks is about graphic novels and comics. Cyberpunk Librarian is about technology and using technology in innovative ways and ways that can help you cut costs. Lost in the Stacks is nice. I like it. It's at Georgia Tech. It's a radio show. So they intermix rock and roll music with academic library talk.
and they do it as a radio show live and then release it as a podcast. Pretty neat. And I would be remiss if I was at the Public Library Association conference and didn't mention, FYI, the Public Libraries podcast, the official podcast of PLA and Public Libraries Magazine. So if you leave this presentation wanting to download and subscribe to any podcast, of course, make it one of mine. But if you're going to do two, then you can make the other one, FYI. So before I leave here, I do want to say that there's other potential uses you could use for podcasts if you're thinking of wanting to do them at your library. You could do story times as podcasts and release them so that your patrons at home could listen to those and help them read along with a book with their kids. You could do book talks. A lot of libraries do visits with authors when they come. They do a short interview with them. The Library of Congress actually does that with the National Book Festival. Around that time, there's always lots of podcasts that come out from the Library of Congress. Library of Congress actually does a lot of podcasts, but they're not on a regular basis. It's sort of maybe random exhibits they have going right then. But National Book Festival is a great time to get a lot of author interviews from them. You could also do an oral history project like NPR's StoryCorps. So once you kind of have an idea of what you want to do, you'll want to have a name for your show, cover art for your show, because you need something that'll show up on your podcast app. And music is nice. It's not required, really, but it's nice to have a theme song, maybe some interstitial music, depending on how it goes, what kind of show you want to do. So there are really three keys to podcasting. You need to be able to record. You need to be able to edit what you just recorded, and then you need to be able to share what you've recorded. I guess the last one could technically be optional, but if you're making a podcast for yourself, that's a little weird, I guess. Maybe you let your cat listen to it. I don't know. But you probably want to share it so other people can hear it. So let's talk those through. Recording. You can have fancy schmancy equipment, super expensive, with lots of mixers and fancy expensive mics and lots of multiple computers and all kinds of equipment that you can have. But you don't really need to do all that. You could do it much more streamlined than that. You could have just a portable recorder. Zoom H4n is really the kind of gold standard. They've done lots of different versions. They've done six versions of it. There's everything from an H1 all the way up to an H6, but the H4n is really where they hit the plateau, and they've done the other ones past their 5 and 6 are still good too, but that's where they really reach their peak, in my opinion. So you could record like that. There's obviously various options you have. You can record in person, and that's what you could use that Zoom recorder for. Or if you're going to record from long distance, you can record over Skype or on a telephone. I generally do mine show over Skype because I don't want it just to be sort of the Metro Atlanta librarian podcast. Or like when I come to conferences like this, I also do recordings. So you also want to have editing software. There's lots of different options. On the Mac, there is GarageBand, which comes free on every computer. There's also Logic, which is Apple's Pro audio editing app. It's a few hundred dollars. On the Windows side of things, there's Adobe Audition. And for both PC and Mac, there are Audacity. And it's a great open source tool. It doesn't look that great. It's a little lacking in user interface design, but it's really powerful and it really works great. And again, it works on Mac and Windows, and it's open source and free, so that's nice. I sometimes use that for more advanced editing than GarageBand will let me do. And to share, you need to have it on the internet somewhere so people can get it. You can host it yourself on your own server if you happen to have your own server. You can host on places like there's one called Libsyn, and that's specifically a podcast hosting and distribution service. There's also another one called Podbean. I personally put mine on the Internet Archive because I like the mission of the Internet Archive. It's free, it's reliable, it's just a great service, and that's where I put my stuff. So when I started out, I was pretty stripped down, other than the computer, which is an iMac, so it was not cheap, but I already had the computer. So I spent less than $100 to get started. I had a $50 mic, that Blue Snowball is the name of it. And then I spent another $30 on the call recorder app, which allowed me to record Skype calls, because it's not easy to capture the audio from both ends of a Skype call without specialized software like that. So I use Skype, which is free and a good way to connect with people from all over the country, all over the world. And I was in the Google ecosystem as far as my blog went, and I used Gmail for my email account, and I used Drive to store files and to share ideas and files with people. I also, again, on the Internet Archive is where I store my files, and I use GarageBand to edit. But all over the years, I was able to upgrade. As you can see here, I went to a better mic. I now use the Blue Yeti mic, and I still use that now. It's about $150. I upgraded my blog to WordPress, but that's really just a personal preference. It doesn't really... There's nothing wrong with Blogger. You can keep using that if you like that. I also have a mobile sort of setup now, so when I come to conferences, it's a lot easier for me to record. I have an iPad mini that comes with a mic, an iRig mic is what it's called. And I use an app called Twisted Wave, and that was, I think, a $20 app, which is a lot for an app, but it's really worth it because I can do some light editing on it, and then I can automatically upload it to Dropbox, so that if I'm out and about and I happen to break my iPad or drop it off the Rocky Mountains into a snowdrift or something, the file is still safe in the cloud. So that's been great too. And Dropbox has been great because it's just another way to share files, just like Google Drive. And there's some other Windows software I wanted to mention. Pamela is the name of a call recorder app for Windows, and I didn't wanted to make sure to mention that. And then I was going to do a brief walkthrough for my show of how I do it. I have a very long list of people that I want to have on the show. It's 300 something probably people on there, and I will never ever probably get through that whole list because I don't have all the time in the world. The Library Journal Movers Shakers list is a great way to do that, to add to that list. So I usually just ask the people if they want to be on, whoever I'm in a mood to talk to at that time. They almost always say yes. The ones who don't say yes don't say no. They just don't reply. Again, that's very rare, thankfully, because librarians, obviously, we like to share our knowledge. So I get their Skype name. We schedule things, unless it's at a conference, and then we talk and figure out a time to have lunch or time to get together and talk between sessions, something like that. I do know a little bit about them if I was asking them to be on the show, obviously, but I'd go do a lot more research and find out what I want to talk to them about. I'll make a list of topics. I don't usually like to write out questions because I don't want it to seem as formal. I want it to sound conversational when I'm doing the show. So I have just a list of topics that I will go back to and jump around with as the conversation comes up. Like if the guest would happen to bring up open access, I could jump down and talk about that instead, even if it was not the next topic that I had planned to talk about. So sometimes people want to see these topics in advance, sometimes they don't. I will share if they want to know, but some people just like to be more spontaneous than that. So we record the interview, and it's really easy. The call recorder app, you just press the red button and it records, and you press the button again to stop it, and there you go, you got it. It'll split the tracks into one or two tracks. You can have one that has just both your audio and the guest's audio, or you can have it split it to where your audio and your guest's audio are on different tracks. So it makes it a little easier to edit if one of them was too soft or something like that. A lot of times I'll upload a copy to Dropbox just to keep it safe there. And then I will drop the audio into GarageBand, do whatever editing I need to do. Sometimes it's cutting out long pauses, like, like that. If somebody does that, sometimes I cut that kind of thing out. Sometimes it's just dropping in the music, sometimes it's dropping in an intro, things like that. So I put it all together, export it out as an MP3. I run it through a program called Levelator, which levels out all the audio so I don't have to keep turning the volume up and down. It should level the audio out so it's all pretty consistent. And then I post it, and it goes out there, and it starts that RSS process, and people who have podcast apps get that delivered to them, and people can come to the site and listen to it, and I promote it on Facebook, Twitter, things like that, and that is how I circulate my ideas. Thank you very much.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Music is by Pamela Klicka. If you'd like to learn more about the show, listen to past episodes, or read transcripts, visit circulatingideas.com. You can follow the show on Twitter @CircIdeas, like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas, or drop me an email at mail@circulatingideas.com. If you'd like to support the show, visit patreon.com/circideas. And please rate, review, and recommend the show on iTunes, Overcast, Stitcher, or your podcast app of choice to help others find the show. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating the ideas. Note to self, edit here.